The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 100 years ago, D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation opened in New York City. The first ever feature-length film, it was also the first movie to be screened at the White House and continues to top critics' lists of the all-time greatest movies. The Birth of a Nation depicted the Civil War and early Reconstruction, featuring white actors in blackface portraying feeble-minded or rapacious slaves, and culminating with masked Klansmen galloping in to save the South from those menacing Negroes. It was America's first blockbuster, setting off a resurgence of savage Klan activity, presenting a whitewashed version of racism and stoking reverence for the noble Southern cause that had been trounced just 50 years before its release. With the debate over the meaning and symbolism of the Confederate flag still flapping in the background, Josh Zeitz wrote for Politico about The Birth of a Nation and the film's enduring influence on American racism and politics. And Josh Zeitz, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
First, a little on the film and the story that it tells.
Certainly. So Birth of a Nation was based on a trilogy of novels that were published in the early 20th century. It was specifically predicated on one of those novels called The Klansman, which sought to retell the story of Reconstruction through the eyes of the vanquished South. And it made villains out of radical Republicans, particularly Thaddeus Stevens, who had been the House Republican leader and leader of the radical faction of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives during the Civil War and Reconstruction. And it was an unabashedly kind of racist novel and film that blamed the chaos and violence of Reconstruction on radicals who presumably attempted to impose black equality on the South in too quick a fashion, rather than on white Southerners who attempted to overthrow essentially the gains of the Civil War through violent means.
So why, given that extreme depiction of racism, is it still considered one of the greatest films ever made?
Well, from a purely aesthetic point of view, it was groundbreaking. The filmmaker, David Wark Griffith, was one of the pioneers of American film. And at the time, it was, I believe, the longest film that had ever been made. It was certainly the first biopic, and it actually pioneered some of the early innovations in filmmaking.
I wonder how viewers, you know, I'm just trying to imagine 100 years ago, maybe the first film that they've ever watched, how powerful those images must have been. How did people react?
Oh, I mean, it was Woodrow Wilson allegedly said that it was like writing history with lightning, although it's hard to verify that he ever said that. But it was, in its time, a tremendously exciting event. It was a roughly three-hour film with all the great actors of the day, including Lillian Gish, who went on to have a storied career in Hollywood. And it was replete with historical reenactments of great moments and stirring battle scenes. It used hundreds and hundreds of actors. It was a tremendous event, and unfortunately it had a profound impact on how people popularly remembered the Civil War and Reconstruction.
Well, you write that the film created the modern and enduring cult of the noble cause. So what did that mean for the nation? Now, this was just 50 years after the decimation of the Civil War.
Sure. Think of this is 50 years after the end of the Civil War, and it's only about 24 years before Gone with the Wind. The film created an enduring sense that the antebellum South had been a marvelous and harmonious society in which slaves and their owners or masters got along perfectly well, in which there was a symmetry of interest, and that the war disrupted this, and that it had been foisted on the South and on the North unwittingly by a group of radical and profane congressmen, Republicans like Thaddeus Stevens, who were seeking to impose a vengeful military rule on the South, and who also sought to impose black equality when it had no place in its time. The film's entire premise was that African Americans that their proper place, that the place they were congenitally fit for, was the plantation and a position of subservience. Remember, this is the high tide of Jim Crow. There had been a tremendous reaction to the brief period of racial liberalism that you saw during the Civil War era and Reconstruction era. This is the high tide of scientific racism, the high tide of Jim Crow. There were two or three African Americans being lynched in the South every week in this period. And on a practical level, it had, you know, a wide-ranging effect in searing into public consciousness a message that was also being delivered in lots of other media through, you know, academic historians and academic scientists were emblazing this kind of sense of scientific racism and skewed history at some of the greatest universities in the land. Columbia University's William Dunning, you know, was the leading scholar of the Civil War and Reconstruction, and he gave a scholarly gloss to just this interpretation. On a very fundamental level, it was roughly around the time that the film was playing in Atlanta in November 1915 that a group of Georgians decided that it was tremendously inspirational, and they founded the second incarnation of the Ku Klux Klan, having been stirred to action by some of the battle scenes and the Klan scenes in the movie. And the Ku Klux Klan went on to have an enormous political sway throughout the country, particularly in the South and Midwest, well into the mid-1920s.
We're talking with Josh Zeitz, who wrote an article for Politico about how an infamous movie, D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation, revived the Confederacy. Well, that, Josh, was the headline for your story anyway. I know you don't write the headlines, but a film revived the Confederacy? Can we really draw a line from that movie to the cause?
Sure. I think the headline, of course, is as you noted, I didn't write it, but the headline, I think, is more suggestive than literally accurate. What the film did was it revived the myth of the Confederacy or of the lost cause. It fed a larger cultural and academic sensibility that viewed the Confederacy as a benign society, that viewed the old pre-Civil War South as a benign society in which there was a mutuality and a commonality of interests between African-American slaves and white slave owners. And according to that mythology, the sort of beautiful world that we would later come to know through films like Gone with the Wind, which was really a second-generation follower to Birth of a Nation, that beautiful world was disrupted by the Civil War and then by Reconstruction. And in point of fact, we now know that the pre-Civil War South was one that was largely governed by violence against African Americans who were placed in a position of forced labor. There was nothing particularly wonderful about that world, but films like Birth of a Nation helped to revive the sort of the idea that there was a lost cause that might have at one point or another been realized.
Well, I want to dig into that a little. I mean, certainly the film had a tremendous influence on culture, but it's also was made and set against a backdrop of a 20th century narrative of the Civil War having been about states' rights or about trade. You argue differently.
That's right. In the early 20th century, academic historians and popular writers and filmmakers and novelists struggled to locate the causes of the Civil War everywhere but in the most obvious place. So there was one school of thought that claimed that the Civil War had actually been about competing economic interests between an industrial North and an agrarian South. An offshoot of that held that it was really about the tariff, about a pro-tariff North going to war with a anti-tariff South. There were still others who claimed, as late as into the 1940s and 50s, that while slavery had been an underlying cause of the war, slavery had always been a major dividing issue between the North and South, and that generations of politicians had managed to kind of maintain a unity and status quo, and that they had managed that issue until the 1850s, when you had a so-called bungling generation of politicians on both sides, both North and South, abolitionists and fire eaters, who excited popular passions for political gain and then somehow lost control of that debate. That was the theory, at least well into the 1950s. I think historians since the modern civil rights era have come to realize that they should take the primary sources from that era at face value, and that slavery was very much the driving force behind the war. For many Northerners, that was not just about or it wasn't even about a commitment to black equality or black freedom. It also was a sense in the 1850s that that slavery was a bad social and economic and political system that was retarding the progress, the material progress of the South. And for many Southerners, particularly those who did not own slaves, there was still a material investment in slavery, which was it was a system that placed all white people on a plane of equality, no matter what their economic circumstances were. And so when you remove that, you were, in effect, opening up a much wider array of inequality between different white people. So I think we have a much more sophisticated understanding of how slavery created the war, and it's not as clean-cut as we once thought it was.
Josh Seitz is an historian and Politico magazine contributor and author of Lincoln's Boys, John Hay, John Nicolay, and The War for Lincoln's Image. You can find a link to read his article, How an Infamous Movie Revived the Confederacy, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The symbolism and history of flags have been a big part of the national conversation this summer, but often missing from the story is any information about their design. Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible brings us the story of a botched design for a city flag that got a second chance.
Here's a trick. If you want to design a good flag, a kick-ass flag like Chicago's or DC's, start by drawing a 1 by 1.5 inch rectangle on a piece of paper. Your design has to work within that tiny rectangle. Here's why.
A 3 by 5 foot flag on a pole 100 feet away looks about the same size as a 1 by 1.5 inch rectangle seen about 15 inches from your eye.
So instead of starting with a big canvas or a wide cinema display,
try drawing your flag on a rectangle that's 1 by 1.5 inches. You'll be surprised at how compelling and simple the design can be when you hold yourself to that limitation.
That, my friends, is Ted Kaye.
Ted Kaye, I live here in Portland, Oregon, and I'm involved in the study of flags.
When I went to his house in Portland, he flew the San Francisco flag out front in honor of my visit. That's the kind of guy Ted Kaye is.
I'm involved with the Portland Flag Association. We're a loosely organized group of people interested in flags, and we are the largest subnational flag organization in the country with the largest membership.
Around 25 dues-paying members.
The most frequent meeting schedule and the greatest amount of publishing.
Unlike a lot of his fellow vexillologists, that's a person who studies flags, Ted is especially interested in flag design. Many other vexillologists are more focused on history, protocol, and usage.
There's one school of thought that says we are flag scholars and every flag is equally appropriate to study, and whether we like the design or not is immaterial. We should be dispassionate scholars.
But then there are people in the second group, like Ted, and me at this point actually, who love beautiful flags and go out in the world and lobby for better ones.
Those who are in the second camp have identified a name for those people, and that's a vexillonaire, an activist vexillologist.
If you've listened to this show for a very, very long time, you know that when it comes to designing flags, there are rules.
The principles being keep it simple, use meaningful symbolism, use 2 to 3 basic colors, no lettering or seals, and be distinctive.
All the best flags tend to stick to these principles, but one rule, the fourth one.
No lettering or seals.
That rule, for some reason, Americans just can't grasp. We have tons of flags with writing and municipal seals on them, and that's bad.
Here's why you shouldn't have a seal on a flag. A seal is designed to be on a piece of paper, to be seen close up, to be seen flat, not moving, and on only one side of the paper. A flag is meant to be seen from a distance on a piece of fabric that's moving and might be seen on the front or the back. Seals don't belong on flags. Seals belong on pieces of paper.
Damn right. One of the intriguing things about the fact that Ted Kaye and the largest subnational flag organization are both based in Portland is that Portland didn't have an official flag for the first 100 years of its existence.
Portland had several flags that had been proposed and not officially adopted, even though people thought they'd been adopted.
But that was about to change in 1969.
a group proposed a flag to the city.
The group was the Commercial Club of Portland. The proposed design consisted of a white field, that's the background color, with a city seal in gold in the center, flanked by two red roses on either side, and then the words World Port of the Pacific on top, and then the words City of Roses below. Oh my. I think I might have to go lie down.
And Mayor Terry Schrunk, who was a very astute politician, looked at this design and said, I'm not capable of deciding on a flag design for the city of Portland. This is a job for the Portland Arts Commission.
Smart guy indeed. But this decision set into motion one of the greatest tragedies and redemptions in vexillological history. The Arts Commission selected an esteemed local artist named Doug Lynch to create a brand new design.
Who was a prominent graphic designer. They called him a commercial artist at the time.
So Doug Lynch created a questionnaire asking both the City Council and the Arts Commission which attributes should be on the flag.
And as you might expect, the members of the City Council had a different view of what a flag should look like from what the Arts Commission members looked like.
You don't say.
The city commissioners were, they wanted realism. They wanted the name of the city on the flag.
Ugh.
They wanted a rose. Ugh. They wanted a mountain.
Jeez.
They wanted lots of stuff on the flag. The Arts Commissioners said it should be abstract. It shouldn't have words on it. Much more consistent with our modern perception of what good flag design is. So Doug went into the fray and designed a flag that did not have a rose on it, did not have the name of the city on it.
It was an abstract design.
Doug's design was I would call it an offset cross.
If you go to our website or pull out your phone, you'll see a variation of this flag that Doug Lynch proposed. It's incorporated into the cover tile of this episode.
Two lines crossing from top to bottom and left to right in the center, creating a void in the center that is called a hypocycloid, a four-pointed star. The blue lines that crossed represented the confluence of the Columbia and Willamette Rivers. The white hypocycloid represented the city of Portland at their confluence. And then those stripes were bordered by yellow stripes, gold stripes, which represented either commerce or grain flowing along the rivers. And everything was on a background of green, representing the forests.
It's really lovely.
City Council said, thank you for your design, and changed the upper left-hand corner from green to blue and put the city seal on it and adopted that flag.
I know all the graphic designers in the audience are digging half-moon-shaped scars in the meat of their palms upon hearing this violation. It's almost more painful that this abomination was so close to being a really good flag, the one that Doug Lynch had originally submitted. It took a few years, but the City Council version of the flag made it out into circulation in 1973.
But being a relatively poor design with that city seal on it. Most people can't tell it's the city seal even. It's kind of a yellow gold blob on blue. The flag was never widely flown.
So nearly 30 years later, Doug Lynch joined the Portland Flag Association.
He was in his late 80s, and I invited him to come to one of our meetings and explain this whole story of how he had designed the flag and how it was adopted, and how it was changed at the last minute. And at the end of the presentation, Doug said, if I had to do it over again, I would widen the blue stripes, move the center of the flag over a little, take that upper left-hand corner, which is blue, and change it back to green.
And he would take that city seal off the flag.
I would make all those. That's how I would do the flag. But it's been 30 years. It's too late now.
And they're like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. We're the largest subnational flag organization in the country.
Look, Doug, it's not too late. Sitting around the table are the person who's written the history of the flag of the city of Portland, the person who's written the guidebook on flag design, the person who actually manufactures those flags, and you, who designed it. We ought to be able to get this changed.
And with the help of future Portland Mayor Sam Adams, they presented an ordinance to the city council to update the flag.
My son Mason, who had written the history of the city flags of Portland, testified. I testified. Mike Hale, who was the owner of Elmer's Flag and Banner, who manufactured it, testified. And Doug Lynch testified. And Doug was a revered figure in design in Portland. And the commission, in effect, bowed and said, you're the right person to tell us what this design ought to look like. We agree with your design. And the mayor, Mayor Vera Katz at the time, the mayor said, that's great. Come back next week and we'll adopt it, but bring a real flag. Can you do that? And Mike Hale, owner of the flag company, gulped and said, yes, we can do that. And so the next week, he'd had his seamstresses sew up a new City of Portland flag. We came to the city council hearing. The council held a vote on the ordinance, 5-0. They adopted the flag, and Mayor Katz said, pointing to the old flag on the flagpole, take that down and put it in archives. Can you put that new flag up? And so one of our members, John Hood, went over and put the flag on the flagpole in the city council chambers, being the first one to raise the official City of Portland flag.
The correct City of Portland flag. This current flag, with all the updates that Doug Lynch wanted, is the graphic that's on the front of the podcast. If you haven't done so already, pull it out, have a look. It's handsome. It's a good flag. Best of all, people in Portland actually use it, especially if you go to a soccer game. If you don't see your city flag anywhere in your hometown, maybe it needs a redesign too. But that's just the Vexlin air in me talking.
And that's Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever. With that memorable declaration, Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce surrendered in 1877 to General Nelson Miles. His words signaling a noble submission, a white flag, knowing when you're lost and being willing to lay down your weapons in defeat. Now wars are borderless, conflicts are ideological, and battles are fought door-to-door in cities and in gruesome videos posted online. Today, declarations of surrender are increasingly rare, almost antiquated, and the world is caught up in what seems like a never-ending series of wars. So what happened? Carlin Romano is critic at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education, where we found his article, Whatever Happened to Surrender, which contains a lot of the lessons he learned from the anthology How Fighting Ends. It's a history of surrender, edited by Holger Offlerbach and Hugh Strachan. Carlin Romano joins us now from Beijing, where he is currently teaching. And Carlin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for liking the article.
Well, it was really interesting being reminded that formal surrender used to be the way to end conflict, which we heard a lot about this year at the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, reminded of General Robert E. Lee's surrender to Ulysses S. Grant. So what happened there that we don't see anymore?
Well, one thing I learned from this book that I relied on a lot in writing the piece, and I really do recommend it to people because they really take us back all the way to prehistoric times. And way back then, surrender was kind of a non-starter. Losers just got killed. So it's really, it seems, in the Middle Ages and into the modern era where surrender becomes a possibility. It's not totally dishonorable. As for today, I mean, one of the things I mentioned in the article was that we don't have clear-cut winners and losers in the way that we used to.
Why is that? Is it the nature of warfare? Are today's combatants ideologically unwilling to admit defeat, or there's just no end in sight?
Well, the book is fascinating on that. One thing that surprised me is that today a lot of military outfits, and particularly the outfits run by states rather than by terrorist groups, don't really go all out for victory. And one of their aims is actually casualty avoidance. And I think, you know, when we see current U.S. policy, whether you agree with it or disagree with it, we understand that we're often trying to avoid casualties, right, with our use of drones and so on. So partly it's that people don't go all out to win anymore. And of course, we have the constraints of the Geneva Convention and laws of war, which didn't really govern things in prehistoric times. So the kinds of things, for instance, that we did, the Allies in World War II, the firebombing of Dresden, killing lots and lots of noncombatants, is really considered unacceptable today for civilized countries. That also makes it hard for clear-cut victors to emerge.
Well, we know Neanderthals didn't, you know, shake hands and drink sherry and agree to stop fighting. What do we know about the origins of surrender rather than just killing the vanquished?
Yeah, well, it seems like mankind had to go pretty far before it really got to the point of accepting surrender. And I mentioned some in my article about how, you know, in ancient Greece, for instance, the Spartans told their soldiers to return, quote, with your shield or on your shield, but not without your shield. You know, you're really supposed to fight, you know, to the death. One thing that seemed to happen in the Middle Ages is that victors recognized that losers and prisoners had value, particularly in regard to knights. So knights often had very wealthy friends and families that would ransom them. And that meant that victors began to think, gee, even if I don't want to feed these prisoners, even if I don't want to take them with us, there's a way to deal with them rather than killing them. You know, we can start negotiating, we can start talking. And as soon as victors and losers started to talk, the possibility of what a lot of the scholars called honorable surrender began to emerge.
How about the whole notion of the white flag? When did that symbolism become used?
Well, it's interesting. White flags actually go back to the Romans. But one of the things I learned, contrary to what I thought I knew, is that a white flag in international law actually doesn't constitute surrender. What it means in international law is we like to talk about surrender. And another interesting aspect of surrender throughout the centuries is that there's something the scholars call failed surrender or tricky surrender, where one party pretends to surrender to draw out the other party and then attacks them.
Carlin Romano is with us, and he wrote Whatever Happened to Surrender for the Chronicle of Higher Education. In it, he explores the concept of surrender, which is increasingly rare in today's global scale warfare. Carlin, contemporary culture abhors this notion of being a loser. So are conflicted parties or fighting bodies today desperate to avoid that kind of stigma of being called the loser?
I do think that is something that has kind of continued throughout history. It's particularly strong early on. I mean, that's what the Spartans were talking about. One of the scholars in this book who wrote about the Roman period wrote that any Roman who did surrender disgraced himself, you know, and his family. So the further back you go in history, it seems the idea that surrender is a disgrace is very powerful. Then a phrase comes up in the scholarship, which I think captures what we're talking about here, sensible surrender. And it's the idea that, you know, when all is lost, when there's nothing you can do against your opponent anymore, it just doesn't make any sense, you know, to keep fighting or force yourself to be killed. And the great writer about war, many people have heard of him, even if they haven't read him, named Clausewitz, German scholar, wrote in a very famous line that all of these people who study surrender quote, that, quote, there is a point beyond which persistence becomes desperate folly and can therefore never be condoned. So he was kind of saying it's just illogical at a certain point to keep fighting. And when everybody began to recognize that, surrender became possible.
How about for a group that is effectively losing a war, losing a battle? What other options are there if not surrender?
Well, one of the traditional options was just to run. I mean, really to like throw your arms down and run as fast as you could and try to get away from the enemy. And that was one way of basically exiting the battlefield. there's something that the scholars called forced surrender, and a particularly strong illustration is the number of times that a horse would fall on a soldier and basically pin the soldier. So there was nothing that could be done. But, you know, basically running, disappearing, fleeing was the standard way to avoid surrender, but avoid also being killed.
And looking back through history, our epic poems, you know, our novels, our songs, and certainly movies, historically have glorified this notion of choosing death over surrender. Why do you think our culture often looks at that kind of sacrifice as heroic, rather than the kind of heroism of saying, let's just stop fighting?
Yeah, well, this was a funny thing I learned from the book also, which is that some of the fighters that you would most expect to live up to that standard, which were the knights in medieval times, were actually the ones most likely to run or to surrender quickly or to quickly send a message to the other side that said, you know, I have very rich friends and a very rich family. Don't kill me. I can get you some money, you know, protect me. And often they were treated extremely well. They might even be invited into the tent and have a nice meal while we contact your cousin, you know. It's a strange thing. But I'd say generally that as individualism grew and as fighters became more upper class than lower class, which they seemed to do in the Crusades and elsewhere, the value of an individual life became very important. Knights didn't want to die for no good reason. When in earlier times, you're basically having the lowest levels of society fight, and their lives are not valued by anyone, and sometimes even not by themselves, you had a greater likelihood that people would kind of go down with the ship and, you know, fight to the last drop of blood.
How about now in this age of the suicide bomber, of Boko Haram, of ISIS? You know, these wars globally publicized online, is the likelihood of surrender becoming even slimmer?
Well, you know, that really does seem to be the judgment of a lot of people who study this, that, you know, one of the co-editors remarks that, quote, the readiness to surrender has rarely been weaker, unquote, you know, in our world today. I think I'd go back to that original idea that prospective winners aren't trying hard enough to win. One thing you see over and over in the history of warfare is that the eventual loser often doesn't give up until the loser's property, family, army has been totally destroyed. There has to be a tremendous amount of pain applied. And the laws of war have in many ways lessened that amount of pain. So I'm not arguing here that we should go back to a pre-Geneva era, but realistic assessment of why surrender has disappeared does seem to be connected to, in a sense, various sides fighting with one hand behind their back. And so battles never get resolved.
Well, Carlin Romano, a lot to think about. Thank you for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Carlin Romano teaches at Beijing Foreign Studies University. He's also a critic at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education and author of the book America, the Philosophical. And you'll find a link to read his article, Whatever Happened to Surrender, where there's more on the book, How Fighting Ends, A History of Surrender. All of it at wordofmouthradio.org.